Hey, you guys, welcome back to Listen Bitch Presents Tell Me Why You're Special. This is where creators, writers, founders, and barely holding it together but still showing up humans get the mic. Not anyone that's sitting on the sidelines talking about it, but the ones actually in the arena, bruised, bold, still standing. Pitch your book, your podcast, your product, or tell us why you should have one, because we're not here for the highlight reels. I want to talk about how your mess turned into a message, how you kept moving while getting your ass kicked in the arena, and what it actually looks like to build something meaningful when you don't have it figured out yet. So in this arena, obviously you guys were not going to bring the fake confidence, no polished Instagram reels, but real people, real courage, real momentum, and I believe this with everything in me. Jesus loves us way too much to leave us stuck, okay? You were created to live in your highest potential and to bring other people with you, to be contagious, courageous, magnetic. Your mess, that's not disqualification, that is your assignment. Today's guest, I'm so excited to have him here. This is pain turned into purpose in a way that most people never consider. Dave lived with bipolar disorder and severe anxiety his whole life. On the outside, we're going to see that successful businessman. On the inside, fighting battles that nobody could see until it all caught up to him. I want him to finish telling the story here and everything that happened. You guys, please welcome Dave Mowry to the show.
Hi, Brandon.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. How are you?
I'm so good. Thank you for your patience. I had a little rough technical start today, but we're making it happen, right? It's definitely not the perfect arena, but it is an arena.
Yeah, we're all good. We're all good.
So I usually start my guests off with the first question, which is, give us your elevator pitch and tell us who you are, what you do.
Okay, Dave Mowry, author, bipolar disorder, severe anxiety. I had everything, successful businessman, happy family, nice house, financial security, and then lost it all due to my undiagnosed bipolar disorder, homeless with the family for 18 months. Started my 14 last years, my dark days, barely function. It was awful. And then step by step, gradually, one step at a time, started to recover slowly. And like I said, it took, there were 14 last years, 14 dark days, which, we're just awful. But gradually, whoops, one step at a time, and got a little better, a little better. Started blogging for bphope.com. Blog's been read by over a million people. Took some of the most popular blogs, put them in the my book OMG, That's Me. And it's a bestseller on Amazon in the top 10 on the bipolar disorder category for like the last 5 years. So, and here I am. I learned stand-up comedy, took a stand-up comedy class for folks with a mental illness, and then now I teach stand-up comedy to folks with a mental illness. And I'm almost whole.
Yeah.
Never totally whole, but almost whole. So that's my 3-minute elevator speech.
Yeah.
And lots of layers, lots of onion, lots of layers.
There's so much. Like, I don't even know where to start right now. I guess like my first question is, how good did you get at pretending you were okay?
Pretending was exhausting. It was awful. I knew if somebody looked at my eyes, they'd see the void, they'd see the emptiness, the insecurity, the self-doubt, the hatred, the loathing. I'd wear sunglasses every chance I could just so nobody could look at my eyes. To go to the mailbox, I'd look outside, make sure nobody else was on the street, so I wouldn't have to run into any neighbors and talk to them and have them look in my eyes. I took to go into the mailbox at night so I knew I wouldn't see anybody. I had my mask on and I was not okay. I was deeply, deeply, deeply not okay, but I pretended to be okay, and it was completely, totally exhausting.
Yeah, I imagine it's exhausting. Is there anybody that called you out at that point? I mean, you've got a family.
No, because I mean, with my family, no, they didn't. They didn't. I kept myself away from situations. My anxiety was overwhelming. It was just overwhelming, and I'd have panic attacks if I had to talk to somebody or be in front of a group or anything, be at a family function and have people come talk to me, I'd start to have a panic attack and I'd start to sweat. And then once I started to sweat, I knew people could see that, and then I'd just sweat profusely and I'd soak my collar and my shirt. And I remember just having to escape. I mean, it was everything I could do, not just to turn and run, but as soon as I could, I slipped out and I went out to the car and I sat down in the car and laid down in the car and just did everything I could do to breathe and just hold it together. Then no, maybe it was the kindness of other people, maybe it was just my self-preservation, but people didn't call me out on that.
Yeah.
And I didn't pretend to be something I wasn't in the sense I just pretended to be okay.
Yeah.
And after we lost everything, lost our businesses, lost our house, lost, people would say, "How's it going?" And I'd say, "It's okay." And they'd say, "What are you doing? Are you working or whatever?" And I'd say, "No, I'm semi-retired."
Yeah.
So that was the biggest, that was my lie. I was semi-retired because I wasn't going to say, "Hey, I had a mental breakdown. I'm totally broken and I can't talk and I can't work and I can't function." So, yeah.
Imagine if we were that honest with people, you know? Like I
Yeah.
we're all in a
Yeah.
whole different place. What does, for someone that doesn't know, can you explain kind of what a panic attack actually feels like?
For me, what happens is, and it comes on sometimes for no apparent reason, sometimes just because I'm in front of people. Sometimes I remember sitting, I took a class when I, during my 14 last years, I did everything. I just tried so hard not to get stuck. I just didn't want to get stuck in that place. So I kept trying. I kept trying to do things. One of the things I did was I took a class at Portland State University. And in the class, I sat in the back right-hand corner because there was no one in to the right of me and nobody behind me, and nobody in front of me could see me, and the only person that could see me was the person on my left. And I never looked to my left, but I had to break out into small groups, and as soon as we did, just the fear, the overwhelming fear, would a sense of dread. I just get filled with a sense of dread. And then the fact of me being exposed and somebody being able to look at me and look me in the eye was overwhelming. And I'd start to sweat. And then I'd just sweat would pour down and soak my collar. And I'd leave the room. I'd just stand up and I'd leave. And I'd go to the restroom and I'd sit in a stall and I'd just try to breathe and hold it together and hold it together until the class was over. And then I'd go back in and pick up my bag, and but my face would go slack, vision would go blurry, voice would go monotone, and just pure fear, just pure fear, just everything I could do, not just not to turn and just run, seriously, just to turn and just to run away.
Wow. That's incredible. So you're juggling that on top of, like, I mean, men naturally, like you're created as that protector, as the provider. It's in the DNA. So, I mean, already just men carry so much just naturally. Like you're born and you grow up and then you carry the stuff on top of that, dealing with these issues. How does your mental health impact your role as a husband and a father?
It was seriously impacted it because before my breakdown, I was an active dad, played with my kids, just Active husband, lots of things, being involved. And when I had my breakdown, it was everything I could do just to get out of bed. Or if I didn't get out of bed, it was everything I could do just to sit on the couch and just hold it together and just be. That was my thing. I just tried to hold it together just to be. And so I wasn't able to be available for the kids, and I wasn't able to be available for my wife.
Right.
And there's huge regret for me around that. Not necessarily guilt because I was doing the best I could, you
Right.
know, but huge regret. The kids, fortunately, my son had friends and spent a lot of time in their houses, and their families helped raising. And, when I was absent, emotionally absent, and he had these other people and they cared for him and they helped raise him. And so he's turned out to be a wonderful person. And my daughter the same way. I'm fortunate about that. One of the things that did happen though was my wife told some people that, I had bipolar and had a breakdown, and told somebody at their school, and before that, kids would come over to our house and they'd play, and our kids would go over to their house. And after my wife told people, and because of the stigma, kids just
Didn't come over.
nobody, the parents wouldn't let their kids come over to our house and play. And so we got ostracized and isolated,
Yeah.
and that affected the kids. But, I must say, my wife, a lesser person would have left
Yeah.
because she didn't bargain for, being homeless and losing everything and struggling like we did. But she stayed with me, and if not for that, I'd be in a single room occupancy hotel in Old Town Portland, just still in that spot getting by. So my wife is the hero of my story.
Yeah, that's amazing. What was the lowest point where you genuinely didn't know if you were going to make it out of this?
Couple of different, actually there's several, because I kept trying, and then I kept, I don't know if failing's the right word, but crashing. I kept trying and I kept crashing and trying, and so each one was unique, and it was a low point. A couple of them, one was down in Portland State after a day when I'd had a couple panic attacks, and my wife was picking me up, and I was just done. I mean, I was done. I was just totally done, and I sat down and leaned up against the, it was a student union at Portland State waiting for her to pick me up, and she was late. And I, like I said, I was just down. I knew if she didn't come, I wasn't getting up. I wasn't getting up. I couldn't get up.
Yeah.
There was nothing left inside me to get up. That was a low point. Another point at Portland State was we were poor at that point, so there were, at lunchtime, there were groups that had meetings in meeting rooms, and oftentimes they'd order food like a pizza or whatever for to feed the folks during the meeting. I'd slip in after the meetings, and when they had extra slices of pizza, that's what I'd eat for lunch. One time I went in and it was pretty much picked over, and there was a half-eaten slice of pizza, and I picked it up and ate it, and that was definitely a low point.
Yeah.
And then there were just, there were several of them, but those were just a couple of them. And I can't remember the third. I had a third one that I was thinking of, but it slipped my mind right now.
Yeah. Well, what is the catalyst? What finally made you say, like, I can't live like this anymore?
I kept saying that. I kept saying that. I mean, I've whatever. I didn't give up. I just couldn't give up. as bad as it was, and it was bad, and it was awful. As bad as it was, I had to keep trying. I couldn't get stuck, and so I just kept trying, and over time, I just began to, I just, began to heal. I just began to heal. And I tried to work. I got a job as a manager trainee at Starbucks, flamed out of that. Obviously, if you're totally depressed, having panic attacks, dealing with people, it's not going to work. But I thought I could do that. And no, I couldn't do that. So and there were other things that I tried to do and just, didn't work. But in 2010, I got a part-time minimum wage, 12-hour-a-week job in a Macy's store downtown Portland. And I rode the bus down. And I worked, and I was able to do it. And it was hard. I mean, used to driving luxury cars and having lots of money, and here I am. Having a bus pass that was donated to me to ride the bus, and I kept thinking, this isn't me, this isn't me. And at a certain point, it was, this is me. And so I never resigned myself to being always being at that low point. I was so pissed off about everything that happened, pissed off that I had this mental health challenge. And eventually I accepted the fact that I have this and it's going to be with me, and I'm going to live with it. But I never resigned myself to where I was at this particular low point as to that being where I was always going to be. And I call that, acceptance without resignation.
Yeah. I see that. In the beginning, you mentioned something about a comedy class. So, my question of all things, how and why did that work?
It's crazy. Who knew? How do you, there's nothing like that that comes to mind and think, okay, at some point in my life, I'm going to do that, especially when I'm in the depths of my mental illness. But when I was in the hospital, in the psychiatric unit, I came up with some jokes. And one of the jokes I came up with is, I'll ask you have to help me with this one, but do you know why they keep the doors locked to the psychiatric unit?
No.
And there's so many people trying to get in.
Yeah. That
So
makes
I came up with that joke. And then this comedian came down from Canada, David Grenier, and he teaches stand-up comedy to folks with mental illness. And he did a show. And so he got up and he did 20 minutes of his jokes about mental health and all that. And I was in the audience and I thought, my jokes are as funny as his jokes. So I decided to take the comedy class. And it turned out I had a knack for writing jokes, laugh out loud funny jokes, and I'll share some of those with you. But I just had a knack for finding humor, and finding humor in those dark days and hard times and dark places. And so I wrote a lot of jokes for myself, and I wrote jokes for other people, and had a talent for it, and then started teaching stand-up comedy to folks with a mental illness after that class was over. But looking for the humor in the dark days really changed things for me. It was transformative for me. I talked about not being able to get out of bed, being so depressed I couldn't get out of bed.
Yeah.
And with bipolar disorder, you have mania and you have depression. And during the mania, I'd have, thoughts about, it's common sexual ideation, something, just think about sex often. And it's just in your mind, and then depressed, you can't get out of bed. So I, after a while, I realized how, and I never know which me was going to wake up in the morning. So after a while, I realized how to tell if I'm manic or if I'm depressed, because when I'm depressed, I spend all day trying to get out of bed, and when I'm manic, I spend all day trying to get my wife into bed.
Yeah, that's funny.
So there were finding and jokes about suicide. I was suicidal. I came close to suicide. I've got a general suicide joke, if it's okay for me to tell it to you.
Absolutely.
When things were during my 14 last years, my dark days, one day when things were really bad, I decided to end it all. So I went into the bathroom and I took a bunch of pills. Afterwards, I called my wife for help. She said there are more pills under the sink.
That's funny.
And you think, oh, you can't tell suicide jokes, but people who have had suicide ideation or understand it, they hear that joke and they laugh.
Yeah.
And it's just freeing. It's just this huge relief, because you can find humor in the dark days.
And you should. It gives you your
You
breath
know, the
back.
jokes are not good. Pardon me?
You should find the humor in things because that's kind of how you get your power back. You know,
Exactly.
everything days took from you, every time you can laugh about it, it means it's not so serious. It means your brain doesn't have to keep going back and locking down on everything you had. I think humor is going to do things that therapy and other methods never could, ever. Humor
It
is
changes the
medicine.
pathways. Yeah, it changes the pathways in your brain. And I'd hear a song when I was driving down the street, and I'd get triggered and think about regrets or a panic attack, whatever, and I'd start to relive that terrible situation, that experience.
Yeah.
And then after I took the comedy class and I had that trigger from that song, I'd think, okay, where can I find the humor in that?
Yeah.
And so it just changed the pathways in my brain, and I didn't go back to that dark spot, and I didn't go back and have a panic attack, a PTSD attack.
Yeah.
I started looking for humor in that, and yeah, it changed, it truly changed everything. I can't, tons and tons and tons of regrets because of the things that happened with my mental health. And things I did, things I didn't do, mania, the things I did, when I was manic, things I didn't do and couldn't do when I was depressed, tons of regrets. But with the humor and with finding the humor in things, it makes it so I don't dwell in those places,
Yeah.
and I just don't ruminate. I don't go back to that spot. I just don't,
That's
and it's great. Like.
yeah, I think that's amazing. And the thing that is really sad to say now is that honestly, Dave, it's not your story isn't special. Unfortunately, right now, a lot of men are going through this. Like it is so common. That men are carrying that depression and that pressure and it's driving them to the bottom and that's unfortunate. But when people hear your story and they're like, "Oh my God, that's me," what does that mean to you?
It means a lot. And like the blog post that I wrote, it was read by over a million people, and the most common comment was, OMG, that's me.
Yeah.
And so people are relating to it. They relate to my story, and they say, okay, I'm not alone. And that's huge, just knowing that you're not alone. And that how it is now is not how it's always going to be.
Right.
And the worst case scenario is when somebody's down and thinks they can't go on, and so they're contemplating suicide. And so when I talk and they hear me, and I try to communicate that, suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
Right.
No matter how bad it is right now, it does get better. It can get better. It will get better. Whether with your mental health challenge, you've lost your wife and your children, relationships, marriages, jobs, things like that. It takes time, and it but heal. And Hopefully the other messages, don't get stuck. Just try not to get stuck. If like for me, getting up and barely making it to the couch downstairs to sit and just to hold it together, just to be. And I'd sit and to not get stuck, I'd sit on a different chair or in a different spot on the couch. And just that little thing was me not getting stuck, me saying I'm not going to be here. And I think just those little things are tiny victories that, and going outside when just going outside, taking a walk, breathing, whatever you can do just to not get stuck and to realize that there is help, there is hope, things do get better.
And I think people take for granted that it really is the little things. It's not like, you're going to come out of this and change everything in a day. That's overwhelming and it's going to keep you exactly where you are. But if you could do one little thing different, like get in the shower today, before you get to the couch, like get in the shower. It's little things. And I think that's so relatable. What do people get completely wrong about bipolar disorder and anxiety?
With the bipolar disorder, what people get wrong is that it is people with bipolar disorder are dangerous, threatening, and to some extent, there's some truth to that. That people living with bipolar disorder are regular people, just like you and me, and just like everybody else. We just have this thing going on in our brain where sometimes we get manic and think we're the greatest and smartest people on earth, and sometimes we get depressed and we can barely move. But we're just regular folks. And with the anxiety, I think. Well, and I think, there's it's getting less, but people think, okay, you can snap out of it, you can do this or you can do that. And so, and we can't. We sometimes, we can't. I couldn't answer the door. I mean, if the door somebody knocked on the doorbell rang, I'd have a panic attack. I couldn't answer the door. I turned off my phone, I couldn't answer the phone. I couldn't open the mail. I couldn't. And so, it's not a choice, and we're not dangerous, and we're just regular folks with challenges. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, she talked about the seven stages of grief, or five stages of grief. I can't remember five or seven, but anyway, one of the things she said was that beautiful people aren't born, beautiful people are made. And the more challenges we have, and the more challenges we can overcome, the more beautiful we can be. And so, people with mental health, are regular people dealing with challenges that many people will never be able to understand, and that makes us beautiful people. One other thing I'd like to mention: you mentioned showering. It's common for people with depression not to shower. Getting in a shower, just getting undressed can be overwhelming. I'd sleep in my clothes. It was too much for me to take off my clothes and, God forbid, put on something else to go to bed. So I'd take my shoes off and I'd sleep in my clothes, so I didn't have to take them off at night or put them on in the morning, because that was just too much. And I didn't shower. I didn't shower. People with severe depression just don't shower. It's just too much. And so one of my most popular blog posts is "Too Depressed to Shower," and it's in my book. And I talk about being too depressed to shower and how depression is good for the environment, because we use less water, we use less soap, we use, we don't wash our clothes because we don't change our clothes, and on and on and on. So, yeah, being depressed is good for the environment.
Yeah, that's a positive spin on it. You're helping other people now. So, what is the moment that you see in someone where you know that they're starting to come back to life?
those of us with the mental health challenge, serious mental health illness, we can see it in each other's eyes. I can see it in someone else's eyes. And when we meet and we talk honestly, and they realize they're not alone and they're talking to somebody else who's been there and had the experience and understands, just that knowing that someone's not alone, that's the beginning of it. And then being able to honestly talk about, to stop pretending. Like I said, pretending is awful and it's exhausting, and people pretend to be okay. And when people are talking to other people with mental health challenges, they don't have to pretend. And so that's where I see in the work I do, working with folks with a mental illness, is just being able to talk to each other, relate to each other, to understand each other, to know we're not alone, to be able to be honest with each other. And what happens if there's two or three, say, three people with mental health challenges, and we're in a situation, we relax, we talk to each other, we find humor, we talk about our crazy days, because there was times when I was absolutely just out of my mind crazy, you know, and we talk about that, and we find humor in our experiences, and we talk about them, and we laugh about them, and people, you know, it's healing. Like you said, laughter is so healing. And so I see that. And then I used to joke, you know, I had worked with a fellow who was suicidal. His parents brought him in. He was an adult, but his parents brought him in. And he was morose, suicidal, had a plan, everything. And coming to see me was his last resort for him. And I talked to the parents and him to start, and he didn't talk, and he spoke in a whisper when he did. And then the parents left, and he and I talked. And, you know, I talked about my suicidal ideation and my experience. And then, you know, I told him the suicide joke, and he laughed. And just a huge relief, the weight lifting off his shoulders. And we came out of the room and back out into the lobby, and his parents were there, and he was talkative and happy. And, you know, I made him promise to come back the next day. And the next day, I made him promise to come back the next day and the next day. And we got through that suicide, you know, his time of seriously considering suicide. But the humor was a big part of that, being able to find humor in suicide ideation and in our personal experiences. That was a huge change for him. And when he thinks about suicide now, he's called me, we talk. When he thinks about suicide, he thinks of the joke. So he doesn't go to where's the gun, he doesn't go to this, or he doesn't go to that. He thinks of the joke. And it lightens it up, he laughs, and the moment passes.
That's an incredible gift that you gave him, and you couldn't have done that without your experience. So I want to ask you my final question before you tell us where people can find your blogs, where they can find you, get resourced. If the mental illness was completely gone tomorrow, who are you without it, and what part of you would you still keep?
The mental illness has given me a compassion and caring for other people. And I don't ever want to lose that. I've got a deep understanding and appreciation of people and people's challenges in lives. And I'm able to help people. And I wouldn't want to lose that. If I could go back, so many things would have changed. If I could go back and not have a mental illness, I wouldn't want to be that shallow person that doesn't have that depth of understanding and love and caring for other people. And the will to really care about other people and help them through their challenging times. So yeah, if I could go back and relive it, I wouldn't. I mean, nobody would choose to live with serious mental illness. But what the challenges have given me, I wouldn't give back.
I love that. To find the beauty in something meant to destroy you, truly. Where can
Yeah.
everybody find you? How do they get resourced with you?
Well, I think read the blog posts are up on bphope.com, and BP is short for bipolar, but it's bphope.com blogs. So the blog posts can be read there. My book, OMG, That's Me, Bipolar Disorder, Depression, Anxiety, Panic Attacks, and More. People read it. Again, they say it sold over 20,000 copies, and self-published. Usually you sell a couple hundred copies to family and friends, and somehow it just, hit a chord. So sold over 20,000 copies. And if they're so inclined to read it, and they'll understand that they'll realize that they're not alone. Because my experiences are their experiences. I've God's given me the gift to be able to communicate what it's truly like to live with a mental illness.
Yeah.
And people read this and they say, yeah, that's me, and realize they're not alone. And that's huge. And then they give it to family members so the family members can understand. And so. And especially men, like you said, living with challenges and depression and mental health challenges and having other responsibilities, to read it is healing. So the book, OMG, That's Me, and it's available on Amazon. And then the audiobook is on Amazon as well. I think otherwise, davemowry.com. And if you want to do a Google search for me, I'm there, all over there. And so that's how to find me, find more about me. And if somebody wants to email me, I'm going to give you my email, because people will want to connect and talk, and maybe somebody's got a good mental health joke that they want to share. But they can email me at davemowry2, the number 2, at gmail.com. And I respond. I remember when I was alone, when I was lost, and when I needed support and help. And if I can provide that for one person or two, that's great.
Yeah, I love that. Well, Dave, I appreciate you coming on here so much, and I'm going to tell you what actually makes you special. It's not just that you went through hell, because a lot of people do. It's that you came out on the other side, and instead of hiding it, instead of wallowing in shame, instead of, squashing it all together, you turned it into something that people can actually connect to. You took your pain and you made it relatable. You took your darkness and you make people laugh in it. And I think there is nothing more powerful in the world than that, because there's people out there right now sitting in silence thinking that they're the only ones. And when they hear you and realize that they're not crazy, that they're not alone, that matters. And I love the work that you're doing. I think that is what makes you incredibly special. And to everyone listening, this is what I want you to hear. You don't have to pretend you're okay. You don't have to hide the parts of you that feel broken. Jesus did not create you to suffer in silence. He created you to come out of it, to live in your highest potential, and to use what you've been through to help someone else breathe again. Call me tomorrow. One more day. Call me tomorrow. One more day. You guys, be contagious, be courageous, be magnetic. Your mess is your message. So if you've been sitting here thinking that you're too far gone, you're not. You are still here for a reason. So if this episode hit you, please subscribe the show, share it, because you need to send this to someone who needs it, who needs to hear Dave's message. And then make sure you subscribe, because there's another story that can help someone else you love. I can't get to them without your help. Make sure you drop a review in the comments. It takes less than 2 minutes to leave a written review. The stars are cool, but I appreciate if you take the time to write the review. And if you're ready to step into the arena, come sit in the hot seat and tell me why you're special, okay? Dave Mowry, thank you so much. Your story was amazing. I'm honored I got to share it with my audience. And you guys, this is the arena. I will see you there.
Bye-bye.